Hello, my name is Marjorie Wingrove, and I'm your host of Death Happens, broadcast through the facilities of Trent Radio 92.7 CFFF. I've created this show as a way to normalize the conversation around death-related topics. Death is inevitable for every living thing. I believe knowledge and preparation can create some comfort and peace of mind. My guest today is a longtime friend, David Evans. David holds a math degree from Western and is a graduate of Ryerson Theatre School. He's worked in voiceover, film, TV, and theater, including three seasons at the Stratford Festival. He's a published novelist and is currently working on a solo show about Robbie Burns, as well as collaborating with his brother Alan on a full-length musical about the business of drinking. Today, Dave will talk about the death of his father and how their large family coped and celebrated during this time of a pandemic.
It's the first time I've had somebody close to me pass away. So, like, you know, my family came from Scotland to Canada when I was 8. Right. We were the only members of our family in Canada, and there were 7 of us. So we were, and they say, you know, there's no Scots like those away from home. Well, that was my family. And I've had people close to me die, but no family member. I have had family members die, but, you know, most kids when they're young, their first experience of death is usually a grandparent, right? Or a distant relative. And so you become aware of death, and you go to the funeral home, and maybe in the UK, open caskets or viewings are not commonplace. It's not part of the tradition over there. It's just, I mean, it depends on what part of the UK, often your socioeconomic class, your faith. But by and large, it's not the trend. There's a funeral and there's visitation, but it's a closed casket at a funeral home. And yeah, so, and that's my family. So when my grandparents died when I was younger, I hadn't seen them but once or twice for a short period of time after we left Scotland. And I have brothers and sisters who don't remember my grandparents at all. I'm the eldest of 7. And
I'm the oldest of 7.
You're the youngest? Okay. I understand you perfectly. my sister, who's the youngest in our family, she's 10 years younger than I am. So when people died in my family in the past, I never got to go to the funeral home because people died, and then you jump on a plane, and the only people who could afford to go were my parents, if both of them. Sometimes it was just one of them. And so death was never something that really closely touched my life in that respect, in the way most people do, until my father passed away this past year. And I'm almost 58-year-old man, and I've now had many deaths that I've been close to. But this one was very, very different. And I had an appreciation for the things that I'd heard people say about a close person passing and how you feel about the whole experience and the process of grief that we all go through, and how that journey was for me. And it was heightened in many respects, and because of the isolation brought upon by COVID. And my dad passed away of Alzheimer's. For the last 3 months, we couldn't see him. And from the time we stopped seeing him, he just rolled downhill so quickly. And the story of, you know, when we knew it was coming, but they just, at one point, my mom had been in a retirement home for 1.5 years, and we took her out at the beginning of the isolation because we felt that she would be safer with us. As it turns out, in aggregate, that was a good decision. But in terms of Chatham, there hasn't been a single case in a retirement home or, you know, that kind of a setting down there. So that's, she would have been fine, but we didn't know that. So we made that decision. So anyway, my mom was away from her peers and the setting where she had some social interaction, but for her children. And so we pulled her out, and then she couldn't see my dad either. And so for 3 months.
Were they in the same home?
No, my mom was in a retirement residence, and my dad was on the special floor for patients with Alzheimer's or memory.
But in the same building?
No. But my mom had no way of getting back and forth except for taxi or if somebody picked her up. She couldn't walk, and she didn't have mobility. She has mobility issues. So she was isolated. But then she was isolated at home with one of my brothers. And then my youngest sister moved back from the States and bought a house. And now my mother's living with her. But the 3 months leading up to my father's death, none of us could see him. And then one day, so my mother turned 82 or 81, I can't remember which, I can work out the numbers, on May 12th. And then it was May 10th. It was 2 days before her birthday. They got a call from the hospital saying, you know, you need to come and see your husband now. He's not doing well. He had reached the point where he had before, maybe about 4 weeks before that, he'd reached the point where he could no longer speak. He would try to speak, but he would open his mouth and you could see, but he couldn't form words or make sound. So that was for about 4 weeks, but we could still tell, we could tell that he recognized us because we were communicating on an iPad with him. They had one iPad in this entire institution for 900 patients, one iPad. So, but this was a government institution, but it happened to be the hospital in Chatham, St. Joseph's Hospital, that had been converted to a place called Riverview Gardens. And it was, you know, a public institution, but that was a hospital where my dad practiced. It used to be St. Joseph's Hospital. So he was in a place where when he first moved in there, he believed that he was becoming a resident doctor again. And he was living in the hospital and he would go around the floor that he was confined to. It was a secure floor. He would go around the floor and he would visit all the patients. And we had some of his old prescription pads and he would make notes and he would come back and he would make notes in his office, at his desk and put them in his drawer. And he found immense satisfaction. And you know, that was just a blessing for him. But so the 3 months that led up to his passing though, he lost his ability to speak. And then when they called my mom, I think it was on the 10th of May, they said, you need to come down and see your husband. He's no longer able to eat. He can't swallow anymore. So you need to make a decision. And at that point, the decision is, do you want to put a feeding tube in and hydrate them intravenously, or essentially, and this is the cruelty of the system, or are you willing to starve your loved one to death? Is what it, that's the decision you're forced to make. And we had already taken the power, you know, the power of attorney, or I can't remember what's the word for it, where we made that decision. We'd already said no extreme measures. My dad didn't even want to be in a home at that point. But we had no option because it hadn't been prepared for far enough in advance and the laws were different. So essentially what happened was my brother Andrew took my dad down and we were all on the farm. He took my mom down and my mom, and they allowed my brother Andrew to go in with her because she couldn't move on her own. She needed somebody with her holding her hand the whole time. So he was allowed to go in, but once they were in there, they were the only ones who were allowed to go in, and they let them come and go for 2 days. My mom's birthday was on the 12th. And then they thought my dad would just expire because he was so frail and tiny at that point. He didn't die quickly. He expired on the 17th. He lasted a week from the time he stopped eating till the time he actually passed. But the first 2 days, my brother Andrew and my mom were there. They were allowed to leave, provided they promised that they would not go and see anyone else. And so she stayed at my brother Andrew's house and he looked after her, and they didn't have any contact with anyone else. And they went back for 2 days, and then it was okay. He could pass at any time. And so then my mom and Andrew basically stayed there. They pulled up a chair. My mom sat beside his bed and my brother Andrew sat on the other side, and there was a cot, and they just stayed there all the whole time. And they would, you know, it wasn't very pleasant. I wasn't there, but we were all put on notice, all the members of the family. And so we, you know, I can't remember the dates, but he passed on the 17th, which was a Sunday, I believe. So we had gathered in locations close to, like I went to London with my brother Gordon, who lived here in Barrie. We drove to London to my brother Michael's place. My sister Jane, who's living in Lakefield, went to Chatham, where she had some friends, and she stayed with friends because we were just waiting for when is the call, like, we didn't really know what to do. We just wanted to be there for my mom and be close to one another. So they gave my dad ice cubes and they sedated him, but not to the point where that would help him pass over, to make him comfortable, reduce his anxiety. And he never seemed to have any problems. And over the course of the last, I think it was 3 days of his life, we were on the phone. We didn't FaceTime because the signal there wasn't very good. And there was something that seemed kind of just not right about doing that. But we called and we would speak to our dad. Each of us took turns calling and speaking to my dad on the phone. We all sent a playlist. Each of us sent songs. My brother Andrew would play the song and put the rest of the phone on his chest. And we'd all choose a song. And Andrew would tell him why we'd chosen that song. And he was reading poetry to him. My mom was singing and holding his hand. So when we knew at one point, they said, okay, there's no way he's going to last another 12 hours. So everybody kind of went to Chatham, and he was on the sixth floor of this building, and my whole family, we pulled into the parking lot that was below his window. So we were maybe 15 meters from the wall of the building, and six floors up, we could see my the window to my dad's room. We all know where it was. We had been there. And so there was all the kids at one point, all seven of us, sorry, no, six, my brother, one brother, Alan, who lived in town. And the joke is he's late for everything, always late. He knew that we were all going there. And my brother Andrew was up in the room with my mom, and they had waved down. And we basically, it was May 17th. We had our cars in the parking lot. We were all out, and we were as close as we could get to the building and still look up and see the window. So there was the parking lot, small sidewalks and grass, a roadway that was not a public roadway. It was just the roadway from the road into the parking lot. And then there was a little, maybe 10 feet of grass, and then up to the building. And we were, so we were all standing on the grass, and we were all standing there looking up the window, and we started singing Scottish songs and songs my dad loved, you know, like the stuff. And then we would get texts from my brother Andrew saying, you know, it's very, very close. And then eventually when my dad did pass away, we were all, Andrew said it's any minute now. He's just, he may have drawn his last breath. And so it was the most, it was very emotional experience being there with my siblings, my brother up there with my dad, who we knew was about to leave us, with my mother, who was quite frail. And we had not seen my dad in 3 months. And we felt so separate from that moment, that very important moment in our family life. And we were singing these songs, the, you know, Scottish songs that we had sung every New Year and that had great meaning for us. And they just came spontaneously. When my brother Andrew came to the window, and he just went like this. And just everybody's arms kind of reached up, and we were just like, there was this collective extension of spirit that happened, so that I felt that my being had gone up through out of my hands and was up there in just inside that room. That was a very, very emotional moment. And there was crying and hugging. And my mom came to the window at one point, and we waved up to her, and then we had scotch, my dad's favorite scotch. And we're standing in the parking lot. We're drinking beers at this point too. We're down there waiting, and we're drinking beer and talking and singing. And then when my dad died, we drank a ball of scotch. We drank, all had scotch. We passed it around and we toasted my dad. And then a red cardinal landed on the lamppost that was right beside us. And I didn't know this at the time, but my sister said, that means something important, you know? And I'm like, oh, okay. I didn't know. Okay. After that moment passed and we were down there, allowing it to sink in and being with one another, waiting for my mom and Andrew to come down, because we knew that would be the next thing. We'd have to, you know, embrace my mother and my brother, who had spent, you know, he'd had the privilege of being there for the last 5 days. Any one of us would have stood in his shoes, but he acquitted himself in a way. He just rose in my estimation because of the way he handled the whole thing. And when my mom emerged from the hospital in a wheelchair with my brother Andrew, we all flocked to her and greeted her, hugged her and kissed her. And then we stood around for maybe another 10 minutes, just talking about it and giving Andrew a beer and having more scotch. You know, being together for those first few minutes. And the caregivers who had looked after my dad, because many of the people who were caregivers on his floor were nurses that he had worked with and knew him as Dr. Evans. And it's a fairly small town. He was a very well-known and highly respected physician. And we were a fairly prominent family in the community just because of our size and my dad's position in the community. Several of them came out and embraced us at a time when that was verboten. You were not to do that. And they commented on, you know, just that they'd never seen anything like this from a family when somebody passed, made even more kind of remarkable by the conditions and how it played out. You know, this family of people standing in the parking lot, drinking beer and scotch and singing songs, waving up to the room where their father was leaving. So that was very emotional. And then we basically went back. I don't remember the details, but we went back to I think it was Andrew's house, and we had dinner there. And then we just sat around and we played songs. My dad loved music, and we just played songs that each one of us associated with my dad. And we sat around drinking beer and talking about sharing stories and stuff like this on the front porch of my brother Andrew's house. The next morning, after some people had to leave because we didn't know, some members had to go back and collect their spouses and their kids. Now that we knew, okay, everybody, now we need to get together, but in a way that is in line with what we know we can do. And at that point, I think you were only allowed 10, 20 people. It might've been in a funeral home. I can't remember the number exactly, but it didn't accommodate. It wouldn't encompass all of the people we had, like all the grandchildren. So in the morning after, I was sitting there and it was, I can't remember how this all played out, but this part I remember perfectly. I said to my brother, Andrew, I said, Andrew, was there somebody else in the room with you? Like when dad passed away? And he said, no, why? And I said, because if you're looking from outside, the windows are here up sixth floor, two panel windows, and they're tinted. So they're dark. And so you couldn't see clearly into the room, but if somebody came to the window and they were close enough, you could not only make out their figure, you could make out who they were and you could see what they were doing with their gestures, but you couldn't see faces or any of that. And it was, so if here's the window, there's a space between the window and the bed. The bed was here. My dad's head was here. And my mom was sitting here in the room in a reclining chair / cot. My brother Andrew had been sitting on the chair on this side. So at one point, Andrew got up, came over to the window, looked down when he was giving us the signals as to what was going on. Yeah. And then he would go back to the seat. And then my mom came, you could tell she came from here towards the window, not up and along. My brother Andrew had come and he'd given us the signal that my dad had passed. And then he went back to his position. And then my mom came to, I saw my mom come to the window and she looked down and waved to us and blew kisses and stuff. And then she turned and walked away. But the reason I asked Andrew if there had been somebody else in the room with him, because in those moments, I saw somebody else there. I saw a figure of somebody. And it was when my mom came to the window, I thought it was somebody who had been sitting where Andrew had. My mom came to the window from your perspective, and this person had appeared in the window beside her, but slightly further back, a little bit taller, my mom, who's like 5'2", 5'3". But I just assumed it was a nurse or a doctor who had been there to say, okay, yes, certify Dr. Evans has passed away, and then leave the room. And this person, then my mom turned and walked away from the window, and this person turned and followed her and just faded into the room. And I thought, okay, there's a nurse in there with them who's been tending to my father in his last moments, so there was a doctor there to certify his passing. And so when I asked Andrew, he said, no, there was nobody in the room with us. Nobody. And I've only had two kind of experiences like that. There were momentary experiences, and that was only the second one I've had in my whole life. I can't come up with a rational explanation that fits, you know, the known data points, but I believe that I saw my father's spirit. I believe that's what I saw. I can't come up with another explanation. I honestly don't believe that at that moment it was wishful thinking, because I wasn't thinking, oh, that's my dad. I was just like, oh, who's that in the room? Like, yeah. Oh yeah, it must be a nurse. And it wasn't until the next morning that I kind of got that chill feeling that you get when you realize, oh, something out of the ordinary happened to me. And then the funeral home experience itself was rather surreal, because when they removed my dad and took him to the funeral home in Chatham, there were, I had to, on the morning that we were having the visitation, because we had a visitation, we had him cremated immediately. And we had a celebration of life in the summer when there's a brief window of opportunity. We had an outdoor celebration out by the lake under a tent with a small group of people. That day I had to, Andrew and my brother Alan collected my dad's belongings from the hospital, and they brought them home. And then we were deciding, okay, what's my dad going to wear? Because we weren't sure if anyone wanted to have to see my dad as he was physically when he passed, because he was less than 90 pounds and he's the same size as me. He was just, we all wanted to remember him as the hale and hearty, lively man that he was. And we wanted to prepare for the eventuality that somebody may want to, you know, kiss him, touch his hand, see him one more time, whatever. And we would make that decision at the funeral home when we were there. So my brother Alan took the clothes we were going to dress him in. And then he phoned me from the hospital. He said, oh, we need dad's teeth. Can you bring them down? So, my dad was like, he was a quintessential Scotsman from the World War II era, like complete falsies, right? So I had to go into Andrew's garage and rake through this bucket of stuff and find this blue plastic container that held his teeth. And of course I had to look to make sure they were in there. But I just remember opening this thing and looking at my dad's teeth. It was I kind of felt it felt as intimate as you can imagine it would feel to look at any other act of intimacy, like holding my father's teeth in this plastic container in my brother's garage on a hot, sweaty Sunday morning in southwestern Ontario. And I just stood there. I felt like I just was transfixed looking at these teeth. And then I just closed them and I put them on the seat of the car beside me. And I drove down to the funeral home and I took them in and gave them to my brother, Alan, who handed them to the funeral director. That was really an unusual experience. Then I went to the liquor store and bought another bottle of scotch, my dad's favorite kind, to take to the funeral home. And then we had a visitation at the funeral home. They have four chapels there. They were all unoccupied. The only funeral that was happening was my dad. So my dad was there in state in his casket with the lid closed, and we had flowers and all the works. And then we went in, and at first nobody really knew what to do because it was just the 10 of us or 10 of us who had been together anyway. So what we start doing, people started taking their iPhones, choosing a piece of music, turning up full volume and resting their phone on this casket. So the casket acted as an echo chamber. So it you know, amplified the sound. We played a lot of songs and we told stories. And then we had a quake circle. So we had a toast. We sang "I Belong to Glasgow." We sang "Flower of Scotland." Then I read a Robert Burns epitaph he had written for a friend. And we toasted my dad. And then we sang "For Auld Lang Syne." There was some like crazy Scottish yelling, like "We are the people," you know, like chanting crazy, like the stuff that would happen at crazy New Year's Eve parties my parents had. There's no way this could have happened if there had been anyone else in the building, because it was like we were like a bunch of lager louts in this funeral home. And it was quite cathartic. Yeah. Then we went back to Andrew's house. No, sorry, you know, I've got my timeline mixed up. It was after the funeral that we drank and ate and stayed up into the wee hours listening to music and talking with my dad. And it was the morning when everyone was leaving that I had the conversation with Andrew about what I'd seen in the window. And so that's how it all played out. And then we had a celebration of life in the summertime, made videos, made toasts, told stories, had people there virtually. We broadcast it on Facebook. We had a Facebook Live event going for those who couldn't attend. I recorded it all on video and I posted videos of it afterwards for those who weren't able to attend. So now we're coming up on the anniversary. I guess it'll be, we're in March now. So April, May, this is like a couple months away. So it'll be Mother's Day, my mom's birthday, the anniversary. And that's the story of my dad's passing. And, you know, I still processing it, but that's it. The most important thing I learned from that experience, other than all the little things that have happened to me that have landed in me that I don't really know, I haven't judged them or tried to make any sense of them other than just accept them for what they were. The only thing that really I find deeply moving and has changed me as a human being from that experience is I have an appreciation for how wonderful it is to have somebody reach out to you in any way, shape or form, just to say, "Hey, I heard your dad pass away. I'm so sorry," or "I'm thinking of you," or "best to your family. Your dad was a wonderful man." And just a one line on Facebook or a message on my phone or a text message or anything, I had no appreciation for how affecting that is and how salving it is to feel people reach out to you and want to just give you a caress of kindness. That really, that's the biggest thing for me is now I know when somebody loses somebody, I know that even though I don't know what to say to them, and what do you say? It's always the same. It doesn't matter. It does not matter. What matters is that you actually do reach out and say, "Hey, I'm sorry that you lost your dad or your pet or whoever." That's the most affecting thing for me. Yeah.
You know, these personal stories, I always say the more personal a story is, the more universal it is.
Yeah, true. Like the more specific it is to an individual and to you, the more, because we all know whether it's consciously or not, we all know that we are unique and we are special and our story is worth being told. No matter how simple or unadorned it is, it's still worth hearing. We share our common humanity is what what binds us.
Yeah. And until you told me last week about your father's death, I didn't, Facebook is one of those, it's elusive. Yeah. You can be completely into part of a story and not know, like, I didn't know that huge part of your life was going.
No, I know. Like, I, there's no, on the other side of that coin is, it doesn't lessen your connection or feeling for anyone if they don't do that. It doesn't change, at least for me anyway, like we all know, like not everybody can know everything that's happening to everyone all the time. Right. Regardless of how important they are to that person, we're all in our own story, right? But all that matters is that when people, it's the feeling that comes from that. I never realized how important that could be to just, it's not a big thing. And I would have never understood what that meant to people until I didn't understand what it meant to people until I experienced it for myself. And this is late in life, I think, to experience that.
Yeah. Thank you, my friend, David Evans. Perhaps Dave forgets that a few years ago, out of the blue, he bought me a ticket to see Donnie and Marie at Casino Rama. He has long known what it means to extend a kind gesture. And we'll finish up with a piece that Dave wrote for his dad called Howl and Dave. My name is Marjorie Wingrove, and this has been Death Happens.
My dad was the life of the party he was at. Wherever he was at, that was where the party was. Music, cold beer, and loved ones. He was a folkie in his youth and a diehard Lightfoot lover, but later in life he got introduced to classic country. He got turned on to Old Willie and Hank Williams tunes. He'd talk in a southern accent and say funny things. His favorite song was Hank Williams' Howlin' at the Moon. And he could get everyone at any shindig going nuts and howling into the night. Crazy. He became known affectionately as Howlin' Dave. I wrote this special lyric for Howlin' Dave, imagining what he might say to us from the great beyond. I look at you and I can see you don't believe it's real. Your smiling daddy's gone away. You don't know how to feel. Don't sit and sigh or wonder why. Just sing out my favorite tune. My bones may be gone, but you know I live on when there's howling at the moon. Brighter that old candle burns, the darker come the night. But don't you fear, my darling one, let my love be your light. No sitting and fretting, you ain't done yet, and your rose is still in bloom. So dry up them tears, put joy in your ears by howling at the moon. Silver back on a cold starry night, light falling from above. That wolf ain't sad, he ain't mad, he's just calling to his love. His soulful sigh floats through the sky, that old dog sure can croon. Singing don't be blue, I'll live on in you, get on howling at the moon. In nights the moonlight wraps around and bends your thoughts to me. Smile on our days, my life-loving ways. Be happy, my spirit runs free. Fill up with cheer and good scotch and cold beer and dance crazy as a loon. Sing the sky knowing I'll never die if you're howling at the moon. Sing to the sky, know what I'll never live or die if there's howling at the moon.